This meeting of the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. We are meeting remotely pursuant to House Rule 10.01. We will start with taking the roll for attendance. Anna, please go ahead.
Chair Becker Finn.
Present.
Representative Moeller.
Present.
Representative Scott.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hur.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Long. Representative Mortensen.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Robbins. Representative Vang. Representative Zhang.
Present.
All right, there is a quorum present. We have a full agenda today, but we do still have to move the minutes from February 2nd. Representative Feist, would you move the minutes from February 2nd, 2021?
Yes, so moved, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Feist moves the minutes for February 2nd, 2021. Any discussion, members? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Opposed? All right. The motion prevails, and the minutes for February 2nd, 2021 are approved. As I mentioned, members, we have three bills on the agenda today. And we have quite a few testifiers on the first bill. So I will just remind our testifiers to be respectful of all the other folks who want to weigh in on this important bill and keep their comments as focused as possible. And with that, we will move on to the first bill, which is House File 75, Representative Moeller's bill. Vice Chair Moeller, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move that House File 75 be recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee.
Great. Your bill is now before us. Please tell us about your bill and just let us know when you're ready to go to testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill reforms Minnesota's asset forfeiture laws, and there have been concerns about Minnesota's civil asset forfeiture practice for years, particularly in the areas of DWI and controlled substance cases. We've heard stories about people whose money, for example, was forfeited in a drug possession case, even if that money was not used in a sale but was instead someone's rent money. We've heard of cars being forfeited even though they were owned by someone who was an innocent owner and not the drunk driver. This is one of those areas where there is bipartisan support and coalitions who often have very different views coming together for reform. The motivation for supporting forfeiture reform is varied. There are concerns about how difficult it is for someone to challenge forfeiture and how it disproportionately impacts people of color. There are concerns about due process to the person whose assets are forfeited. And there are concerns expressed about how the proceeds of forfeiture are utilized. Members, now is the time for us to enact these important reforms. And you will hear from stakeholders who have spent so much time working on this compromise language, even engaging in mediation to create this bill. As I mentioned, this is a compromise bill, so not everyone is happy. But this bill goes a long way to create a fair system for Minnesotans. I would also note that forfeiture reform is a recommendation of the House Select Committee on Racial Justice. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn this over to my testifiers, and I believe Bob Small will be the first one.
All right, Mr. Small, please go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert Small. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and I am here to testify this morning in favor of the Forfeiture Reform Bill. Some members may recall that I testified in 2019 on a very different Forfeiture Reform Bill. I testified in opposition to that bill. However, it was clear to our association that there was a strong legislative intent in making progress on improving our forfeiture laws. So in the interim, Our association took on a leadership role and, as Representative Mueller mentioned, engaged in a first-of-a-kind mediation-type negotiation session with members of both sides of this issue and met for many, many, many months. And the result of that is the legislation that you have before you. It was a process, as I said, that went on for months, and we heard all kinds of both sides of the issue. It's not perfect, as Representative Mueller indicated, and certain provisions give our members concern as well as concern for other folks, but it is truly a reflection of true compromise. We stand by that compromise legislation, and we appreciate the efforts of all of those from both sides of the issue, and particularly Representative Mueller for her willingness to carry this bill forward. You'll hear from an assistant St. Louis County attorney who is an expert and specializes in the area of asset forfeiture, and then she and I will stand for any questions. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Small. Next on the list, I have Bill Ward. If you could please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is William Ward. I'm the State Public Defender from Minnesota. The consortium that Judge Small referred to and that I've been a part of looked at the data, reviewed the values of the forfeited property. And our compromise that people keep talking about is not perfect. We looked at $1,500 as a threshold, and through the data, we learned that this is approximately 70% of all forfeitures in the state of Minnesota. By focusing on this, what we decided as a group was that if we had a threshold level, it would refocus law enforcement away from small forfeitures, which has a substantial impact on individuals who can least afford to lose any assets. There have been abuses over the years. We all know that. But as important under the existing law, if folks want to reclaim their seized property, they got to go through an arduous and often expensive process. What happens then is this process would cost more actually than the property's actual value. And please understand that this is a civil process. This is not a part of any criminal proceeding. I feel it's important to point out to this committee that my office, the Public Defender's Office, does not represent clients on forfeiture matters, and we're not authorized to do so by statute. The reason I was a part of this group and asked to be a part of it is my clients are disproportionately affected by these seizures. What does this tell us, okay? If we're not allowed to do it, and our agency represents the vast majority of all those charged with criminal cases in Minnesota, if our clients have their property seized, we cannot assist them in getting it returned as part of our obligations on the criminal cases. The poor and disproportionately individuals of color are having their property seized with little recourse. They don't have the means to hire private counsel. If they did, we wouldn't be appointed in the first place. As you've been said, or has been said by Representative Mueller and Judge Small, some of the group felt this went too far. Many felt it didn't go far enough. But ultimately, everybody agreed that the status quo is not good and that something has to be done. It's not perfect, no compromise is, but it will address the current structure, which is fundamentally unfair to the indigent and disproportionately unfair to communities of color. I stand in support of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Ward. I will note for the record that Representative Robbins and Long were here before the testimony even started, but they missed the roll call. We will move on to the next testifier. I have Nora Sandstead. Ms. Sandstead, if you could introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. My name is Nora Sandstead. I'm an assistant county attorney in St. Louis County. I've been handling forfeitures for our office for the last 7 years or so, several hundred a year. So I've been through thousands of forfeitures, DWI forfeitures, drug forfeitures, plea forfeitures are the most common we see. I partner with about 20 different law enforcement agencies around St. Louis County. We have the largest geographic county in the state. And so we work with a big number of agencies and see a variety of different ways that forfeitures are handled at the local law enforcement level. So I brought this experience working with the County Attorneys Association and this coalition to develop this compromise forfeiture legislation. And I wanted to talk just briefly about the reasons that we saw from the County Attorneys Association perspective, the need for improvement on existing forfeiture law. And a big part of that was a case that came out a couple years ago, the Olson versus the Lexus forfeiture, that said our due process protections in the existing forfeiture law were not quite sufficient in the case of innocent owners. And so reading into that case, what the court ordered, but also what we expect to come from future challenges, we saw the need to enhance protections for innocent owner claimants of vehicles in forfeiture matters. We also saw with this coalition and this mediation process, the opportunity to enhance the efficiency of forfeitures, which can sometimes take more than a year when they're following the criminal forfeiture process. And that's fine if you don't have someone who's a separate innocent owner who isn't involved in the criminal process. But oftentimes when we have a challenge forfeiture, it's because there's someone other than the defendant who is claiming ownership of the process of the property. And so to get a quicker hearing and to ease the process for those folks was an important objective here. We also saw an opportunity to clarify the law to enhance fairness and the consistency across agencies, across counties, across the entire state in terms of how forfeitures are implemented. So our objective was to balance these goals for enhancing due process rights with fairness and efficiency, but also to ensure that we were still able to pursue forfeiture when it's appropriate for serious felony DWI and controlled substance crimes. So I'm going to highlight the major changes that are found in the bill, and happy to take any questions as well. In terms of the DWI forfeiture changes, the main takeaways for the committee are that there will be fewer forfeitures. There is this bill limits the scope of which crimes are subject to forfeiture. And currently, we have DWI forfeitures for felony DWIs, second degree DWIs, and third and fourth degree DWIs when someone has a alcohol restriction on their license, or they have a license that's canceled, inimical to public safety. So it's kind of a big bubble of vehicles that can be seized for forfeiture. The new bill says we're going to limit that to felony DWIs and second degrees when it's the third incident within 10 years. So that's going to reduce significantly the number of vehicles seized for DWI forfeiture. The bill also creates a separate process for innocent owners to challenge forfeiture than it does for the defendant drivers challenging a forfeiture. And it eliminates the filing fees for both anyone challenging forfeiture. It creates a process whereby innocent owners are going to be notifying in writing the prosecuting authority, the county or the city that is handling the forfeiture, but they don't have to initiate the case filing themselves. And I've seen a number of times throughout the years where someone has struggled with the ability to serve properly that county or the law enforcement agency. And so this should help ease those burdens on someone claiming property. When the prosecuting authority is notified of that forfeiture challenge, then they're going to take a look and decide whether or not to continue the forfeiture at that time. And the burden will be on the prosecuting authority to then file the forfeiture action with the court if they want to pursue the forfeiture. Otherwise, the vehicle will be returned at that point. And we've got, there's still a 60-day window for someone to challenge the forfeiture. The prosecuting authority only has 30 days to determine whether or not to continue the forfeiture, and then the court would be required to hold a hearing within 30 days again on that innocent owner claim if it goes forward. So that process is a lot more favorable for innocent owners, doesn't add too much burden to the prosecuting authorities, and should hopefully result in vehicles being returned to folks who should be receiving their vehicles back quicker. There's also a reduction in cost for vehicle forfeitures because there is no filing fee involved in a challenge. The storage costs are going to be limited when vehicles are returned, and there is no bond requirement going forward on the interlock provision. That is, let me touch on the interlock provision really quickly. That was a new piece of legislation in 2019. It's been implemented slowly and somewhat differently across agencies. And currently, it's a provision that says, if your vehicle is seized for forfeiture, you can halt the forfeiture by enrolling in interlock and get your vehicle back as long as you're a participant. And the current statute allows for agencies to require a bond. And in my experience, most agencies do not require a bond to release the vehicle, but some of them do. And this legislation would eliminate that requirement or that possibility of requirement of a bond. It also limits the interlock participation to those who have been charged with a felony DWI who are participating in treatment court. So it makes the interlock provision a little more limited. But going back to our scope of DWI forfeitures shrinking quite a bit, we're going to be dealing with many fewer vehicles anyway. So that's the main points on the DWI aspect of this bill. There's also changes to the controlled substance forfeiture statutes. There is the threshold set at $1,500 for seizure of currency that's seized related to controlled substances, unless there is probable cause to believe that the money was exchanged for the purchase of controlled substances. So unless law enforcement has evidence that is convincing that the money is drug proceeds, essentially. Currently, as the law stands, we have a proximity rule where money can be seized if it's found in proximity to drugs. And there is not a heightened standard on that. So this would tighten that up a bit. It would tighten it up actually significantly in many cases. The bill also narrows the property that's subject to forfeiture to that which is an instrument or represents the proceeds of a controlled substance crime. Before, we had kind of a laundry list and a paragraph of how the property can be related to the drug crime in a variety of different looser ways. This bill also significantly restricts vehicle forfeitures in drug cases to those vehicles that are used for the transportation of controlled substances for sale. So essentially, we're restricting vehicle forfeitures to drug dealers rather than individuals who may be addicted but may find themselves with a felony amount of controlled substances. This also uses that enhanced innocent owner provision challenge process for vehicles in the controlled substance area, the same as it does in the DWI area. So those enhanced protections carry over. And it clarifies the use of administrative forfeiture proceeds for agencies. It sort of makes that provision more uniform across agencies.
Ms. Sand said we do have a couple more testifiers, and I know members are going to have questions. So if you want to wrap up, that would be really helpful.
I can do that. I'll just point out the other big provisions are that there's enhanced reporting requirements. The big change in that is that spending of forfeiture proceeds would be required in reporting. That would be new. There's a provision regarding federal sharing and a study. So I'll take any questions you may have.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Sanstead. I know whoever, draws the straw to walk through the whole bill has a little heavier lift. So I thank you for making sure we had all that on the record. I do want to get to, we have three more testifiers on the list. Next on the list is Bill Hutton. If you could introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
All right. Good morning, Chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Bill Hutton. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, representing the 87 Sheriffs of Minnesota. I'm not going to go over what has already been shared by Judge Small and Bill Ward. I simply wanted the committee to know that the Sheriff's Association participated in the process and that we support the bill. I also want to thank Representative Moeller for bringing the bill forward, and I will leave it at that. Thank you.
Short and sweet. Thank you, Mr. Hutton. Next, we have Julie Blaha, our state auditor.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Becker Finn and committee members, State Auditor Julie Blaha. And with me today are also two of our OSA researchers, John Jernberg and Christy John. As you know, the Office of the State Auditor oversees over $40 billion in local government spending. We do that with examinations, investigation, support, and of course, analysis, gathering data and providing context. And our analysis work comes into play today. Our office releases an annual report of the asset forfeitures that are governed by Minnesota statutes and are based on the data that's required to be reported to us. If you want to see this report for yourself, we've included it in the committee materials today, and you can go to our website and find it. Not only can you get the actual report, but you can also get the underlying data if you'd like to dig in and find your own patterns in the numbers. So based on our data, we believe that this bill starts the right conversation, particularly around small forfeitures. We found that in 2019, the net value of all forfeitures in the $1,500 or less category was about $1.5 billion. Now, the average size of an individual forfeiture in that category was about $473. And that category accounts for 75% of all the forfeitures that result in proceeds that we monitor. Furthermore, these numbers were typical of what we've seen over the past 5 years. Now, proceeds from small forfeitures are at best a minor and unpredictable part of local government budgets. Total government spending on police and sheriff services in 2019, for instance, was just over $1.7 billion. That means small forfeitures, all of them, accounted for only about 0.4% of those budgets. Now, changes in such a small fraction of a budget are definitely manageable. Small enough fraction, in fact, that the state could either could also offset the loss. It's always a good idea when state legislation impacts local budgets, but that's for another bill. Now, on the other hand, if a low-income person experiences a forfeiture of even a few hundred dollars, the impact can be catastrophic. It may mean the difference between making rent and experiencing homelessness. And while we can all agree that there should be consequences for crime, it's worth remembering that some of Minnesota forfeitures laws, again, allows forfeiture before a person is convicted. And even when they happen upon conviction, low-income people experience disproportionately high and often unintended consequences when it comes from small asset forfeitures. So small forfeitures offer minimal financial benefit at the system level and disproportionately negative impact on individuals at lower income levels. So restricting small forfeitures will have big benefits with little cost. So based on that, we appreciate the restrictions on small forfeitures included in the bill. Now, one caveat here is that the most common criminal activities leading to seizure, forfeiture, and final disposition of property in 2019 were DUI and controlled substance related. That accounts for 94% of the forfeitures. So some of the other restrictions that are here that have to do with the type of forfeiture involved will need to temper our expectations a bit about the overall impact of these restrictions on the numbers I just gave. Finally, on a technical note, we really appreciate the consideration given to oversight in this bill. Oversight works best when it's considered early, and we're glad to see reporting updates in this bill. We also appreciate the idea of the audits described starting on line 24.4, but we do believe we could examine or review the procedures referenced here without having this specific language in the bill.
We believe that our current options to investigate would be adequate to handle these concerns, and they're already part of the OSA's budget. The current language about audits would cost about $160,000 per year. Now, we're happy to conduct the audits that you ask, but removing that section may be a more cost-effective option and still get us a similar level of oversight. So again, thank you. We believe this is the right conversation, and we appreciate how you are using data to improve forfeitures in Minnesota. And with that, we'll be available throughout the hearing, and particularly also our data experts will be available to you throughout the hearing on this topic. Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Auditor Blaha. And I think many of us know if you want to get into the weeds on the numbers, our state auditor is ready to give you those numbers to dig in. We do have one more testifier on the list, Lee McGrath, if you want to go forward with your testimony and introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to raise some concerns today. Regarding House File 75. My name is Lee McGrath. I'm legislative counsel for the Institute for Justice. The Institute for Justice is the nation's leading advocate for forfeiture reform. Just one example of that is that today my colleague is standing in front of the Indiana Supreme Court on a remand from the United States Supreme Court in Tyson versus Timms on the question of proportionality. I have many concerns about this bill, but I want to focus in on just one, Madam Chairman, and that is the important issue that was raised earlier by the Office of the Public Defender and just raised by State Auditor Blaha, very passionately raised and importantly raised by State Auditor Blaha, and that is the question that there of the 8,000 forfeitures that occur a year, roughly 20 a day, the vast majority of them are tiny. As State Auditor Blaha said, one calculation puts them at $473. The problem in the bill is that the threshold of $1,500 that was earlier mentioned is illusory. If I could ask the committee to turn to the bill and to line 15.12, that's 15.12, you will see that the third word is or. It reads, has a total value of $1,500 or more, or there is probable cause to believe that the money was exchanged. Well, that means that all this discussion about the threshold is not coming into effect. This is just a repeat of the current law that all you need is probable cause. Similarly, the illusory aspect can be seen on the next page, on page 16, and on 1610, in which money may be forfeited under an administrative process if it is on line 11 in proximity to controlled substances. This issue of threshold is the most important issue. That we face. Fortunately, there's other legislation in the other body and that may be considered by this body that goes after this most important issue that addresses the enormous failure rate that exists under the current system. Under the current system, 78% of cases do not get litigated. Property owners walk away from their property for many reasons, including that the property value is too small relative to the cost of litigating in civil court. Madam Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to testify. There are other concerns that I have. I appreciate the committee's commitment to this issue. It's been a longstanding issue that I've worked on with others, the people of good faith in the past, and hope to continue to do so in the future. Thank you.
All right, and with that, we will get to member questions. First on the list, I have Representative Novotny.
Apologize for that. I was trying to read the bill and the notes he was making there. My question was for Assistant County Attorney Sandstead. you mentioned that you handle about 200 forfeitures a year in St. Louis County. Is that correct?
Yes.
Ms. Sanford. All right. Thank Representative you. Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Moore, Chair Beckerfin. So the question I had is, out of those 200, how many are actually involving over $1,500? And just a follow-up to saving the time, you know, out of that 200, how many in St. Louis County are actually appealed?
Ms. Sanstead.
I missed the last part. I heard the how many are over 1,500.
And then he was asking how many are appealed.
Okay. And I don't have exact data in front of you, but I can give you my ballpark. I think that one thing I want to distinguish is that the $1,500 value applies to controlled substance forfeitures. So, half or more of the forfeitures I'm handling are DWI. So of the controlled substance forfeitures, I would say we're probably 15% are above $1,500.
And then as to the appeal question?
And the challenge, what percentage are challenged? Probably about 10% of controlled substance forfeitures are challenged. On DWIs, it's maybe more like a quarter to a third.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Sanstead. And I will note Ms. Sanstead is speaking from her experience in St. Louis County. Representative Novotny, any follow-up?
No, thank you, Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative. Next on the list, Representative Mortensen.
Thank you, Chair. I don't know who would have the data here, but my question around vehicles, if this were to go through, is there an estimate as to how many fewer vehicles would be involved in asset forfeiture?
Representative Moeller?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I don't have the answer to that, and I'm wondering if perhaps either Ms. Sanstead or Judge Small would know the answer.
Right. Whoever thinks they can take that one, please go ahead.
Chair Beckerfin, I can handle that. In terms of vehicles for controlled substance forfeitures, this would shrink that number by quite a bit. I think more than half of the forfeitures would be eliminated if we're just looking at folks who are transporting drugs for sale. In terms of DWIs, I think this would be a reduction of a third is my best ballpark.
All right, thank you. And I'm sure we could get that data with some more exact numbers that we could send to members after committee as well. Any follow-up, Representative Mortensen?
No, thank you.
All right, next on the list is Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you both to the groups that have worked really hard to come to this compromise. And I know it took a lot of effort and a lot of time. And thank you to Representative Moeller for her leadership on this important topic. I had two questions. First was for Ms. Sanstead. I was wondering if you could respond to Mr. McGrath's comment about the or probable cause and how that compares to the current law, if you could help the committee understand that.
Ms. Sanstead.
Sure. So existing law requires my office to certify probable cause for forfeiture in administrative forfeitures. But technically, we only have to certify there's probable cause to believe that the money was in proximity to the controlled substances. So the new standard would be probable cause to believe that the money is actually drug proceeds rather than just nearby the drugs. So that's the distinction in probable cause between the proposal and existing law. I don't have much disagreement with Mr. McGrath's pointing out the or provision regarding the $1,500 limit. It is an either or. There is the ability to forfeit drug proceeds under $1,500 in this legislation when there is that probable cause.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Ms. Ansah. That would seem like a pretty meaningful distinction to me, whether you know that the money has, or whether you have probable cause to believe that the money was used for drug crime, or whether it's just in the room or in the house. So, and then my second question is for Auditor Blaha, and wanted to follow up on your comment about the additional audit language requirement in the bill. Wanted to just ask for the audits that you're conducting right now. Do you have any concerns about the information that's being shared that, you know, you think an additional audit would help with, or do you feel like the information you have right now is enough to do the investigations that you'd suggested?
Auditor Blaha.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn and Representative Long. For what we're seeing is some of these procedural kind of looks here. I don't believe that we necessarily need to spot check those. I don't know if we're hearing of a problem that would suggest that. The data that comes into us, we believe, has been effective, that people have been clear, and we feel like the reporting has been complete. When you add a piece in that says we can audit something, and that is the expectation, is that we are auditing it that we are basically recovering it. So my concern is that there will be an expectation that we're doing this kind of an audit. Also, if we were to keep the audit language, we do have to change a bit what this language is, since these are not financial audits, and got some financial audit language in there. We don't see necessarily a problem. And when we talked to the original, the authors of the bill, it seemed that what people were looking for most was the idea that if they did not trust what was going on, that they had a recourse, that they had an option. I think it was more about being able to react to concerns more than proactively going out and spot checking. So I believe that what people are looking for is a recourse more than a proactive look. So in that case, the recourse is already there. And if you take this out, it will reduce the cost and still get, I think, at that concern. Very good question.
Any follow-up, Representative Long?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my apologies, I've been in and out of this meeting because I've had a lot of Zoom trouble getting kicked out. So I missed some of the testimony, but I have spoken to Representative Mueller previous to the hearing and many of the advocates, and so I do feel like I'm up to speed. But I just wanted to say, first of all, thank you to everyone who's been working on this. This is an issue that I was unaware of really before I became a legislator 2 years ago, and I became really concerned about it when I heard about it last year. So thank you to everyone for your hard work. I do plan on supporting the bill now, but I just wanted to flag that I am working on the alternative that Mr. McGrath referenced, and I actually hope to drop it today. I didn't get final jackets until Monday and wanted to be sure I was really dotting all the I's and crossing the T's and talking with everyone before I dropped it. So I just want to say, even though I'm supporting this effort, I think there's more work to do. And the reason is because in our system, I don't think it's fair that people forfeit their property, their assets, when they have not been convicted. And so the continued to track civil and criminal side just is not fair to citizens, especially on these low dollar amounts. So I appreciate the effort everyone has worked on. My alternative, just to be clear, gets rid of the civil side altogether. It leaves a lot of room for law enforcement to seize things that they think are incident to the crime without a warrant, so they can seize it, but it is not forfeited unless there's a conviction. And I just think that distinction is very important for members and the public to understand that people shouldn't be losing property if they have not been convicted. But there are many exceptions that I've worked with law enforcement on, including, informants, and if there's an exception for if they're working with Federal Drug Task Force, and there's an exception for federal adoption. So there's many ways in which it can still go into the civil side with federal that really gets at those big dollar crimes and the drug task force issues that we really want to address. We want to get drugs off the street. We want to get criminals off the street. but for these low-level dollar amounts, I just want to say that I know a lot of you work so hard and you want to be done, but I'm just putting it out there that I hope we're not done, and I hope we can continue this conversation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yep, and I'll just remind members the bill before us is this bill, House File 75, and I do think a lot of work has gone on over the course of many years, and as noted by many at the beginning, you know, compromises are rarely things that either side is going to be as enthusiastic about as they would want to be, but I do think that the public does expect us to reach compromise and move things forward, and a step in the right direction is a step in the right direction. So we have one more question from Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, well, it's so interesting. I've been working or tracking this issue at least for quite a few years, and boy, have things changed since I started working with Mr. McGrath on this years ago. So, I absolutely hear what Representative Robbins is saying, but, you know, I support this compromise. I'm really glad to see more progress being made. However, I do have my kind of broken record issue that I must bring up when this is discussed, and that is the issue kind of alluded to by Auditor Blaha that local governments are making money off of this process, and that there is a cut to law enforcement and a cut to prosecutors for doing these forfeitures. And I continue to believe that as long as there is a cut, no matter how small, that it undermines the credibility of law enforcement and it undermines the credibility of prosecuting agencies. And so I'm really wondering why that's still in the bill. I mean, Auditor Blaha talked about what a tiny little piece of this it is, and yet I think it has this really corrosive effect. Not that anybody is policing for profit, but it raises the appearance that they might be. Especially concerning to me is where now, I mean, it's better that it's easier to get a car back, that you don't have to go through this arduous process, and yet the person is being told to apply to the county attorney. And the county attorney is getting a cut. So there is an inherent conflict of interest. So I guess what I would really like to do is ask perhaps Judge Small why this is still in the, why we're not getting rid of this aspect of the law. And, you know, I'm not going to talk after he talks. So I just do want to emphasize that I do appreciate the work that's gone into this. I have a really good sense of how hard this is. And I absolutely am going to support the bill.
Judge Small, do you want to answer that question or attempt to?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Representative Liebling, yes, you are correct. That is the same questions that you ask all the time. And I never have a good answer satisfactory to you. And I appreciate that. The proceeds of the forfeiture are to be used for certain specified reasons, and those specified reasons include education, public education, and the like. And so we thought that it merited to remain in the bill.
All right. And with that, our Vice Chair Mueller, any closing comments before we move to the vote?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really don't, and just want to thank all the testifiers again for all of their hard work in getting to this compromise language, and I hope that you can support the bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, members. This is, I think, the most complex bill we've had in front of us this year so far, so I appreciate folks paying attention and asking good questions. There are no amendments to House File 75. Vice Chair Mueller will renew her motion that House File 75 be recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Herr. Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen?
Aye.
Representative Novotny?
Aye.
Representative Farr?
Aye.
Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Representative Hurt?
Aye.
We have 15 ayes and one nay.
With that, how the motion prevails and House File 75 is recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. Thank you to all of our testifiers. That was a good discussion, and I think we hit on all the points that we need to hit on with that issue. So good job, Vice Chair Moeller. With that, we'll move to the next bill on our agenda today. That is House File 575. It is a Representative Hewitt bill regarding notary publics authorized to perform civil marriages. Welcome to our committee, Representative Hewitt. I think you're here. Yep. I will move your bill. I will move that House File 575 be recommended to be re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee. We now have 575 before us. I believe, however, before we really get into the meat of the bill, I believe you had an author's amendment, Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I do, I would like to adopt those amendments if someone can move them.
All right. It is the A1 author's amendment. It puts the bill in the shape that the author desires. I will move the A1 amendment. This one will be a voice vote, is there any discussion to the amendment before we move forward? All right. With that, all those in favor of moving the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right. The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Hewitt, please tell us about your bill, House File 575, as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to turn my camera off. I'm in the Senate office. I'm in the House office building and the internet is unstable, it said. So we're going to go forward if that's okay with you.
Yeah, please proceed, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. This is my first time ever before the Judicial Committee, and I am honored you'll have to accept my virtual donuts. So anyways, House File 575 actually came up in a personal matter, actually, because I was studying to be a Catholic deacon and in my final stages of application, and on the checklist it said, have you ever performed a marriage or ordained in another ministry? And in Minnesota, and able to perform a marriage, you either have to be a judge or you have to be an ordained minister. And the way I did it was kind of shifty, but it's the way our law says it, is I went online, and I believe it was the Church of the Rising Savior or something, authorized me to do it in 2 minutes, took it down to the county, and got it done. And I had to put that on that checklist. And basically now for me to proceed at some time in my life to become a deacon, my paperwork has to go off to Rome to get a special dispensation. But then I talked to Representative McDonald about the same thing, and he wasn't aware of it. And he's a devout Catholic. And he said, oh, my God, I committed one of the big sins. And so we just both together thought that this is very cantankerous and cumbersome. Now, I know there's judges on the online today here with us, and I don't want them to think I'm taking away any responsibilities of theirs, but this will put it into, by having notaries have this as one of the things they can possibly do, I think it's a real good way, because I was looking at the law with the having religious only do this, but I think in this setting, and the Secretary of State's office came to me about this, that we can actually hold notaries responsible for all the stuff you have to do to actually file the certificate and things like that, where right now, when this got published and out, I heard from a couple brides that said, I didn't know I wasn't married because my certificate of my husband's buddy never filed it. And so those are problems that we have to look at. And I think that this really fixes the problem. It allows notaries who are people of good character. All of you are notaries on the committee. And so you're all of good character, I'm hoping, but throughout the state, I think that we hold notaries a little higher and we can hold them responsible. So that's my bill. Stand for questions, Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. And, you know, I think it is important, you know, this is regarding civil marriages and, you know, it's a contract is ultimately what a marriage is. So I appreciate you bringing this forward. I see we have a couple folks from the Secretary of State's office available for questions if members have them. It looks like Representative Johnson.
Chair members, I just have a few questions on this bill. I'm wondering if Representative Hoyt could answer them. First of all, he brought up the ex officio notaries. Do you know who all they are so our members do? Because there is a rather long list.
Representative Hewitt.
I would ask to call a friend here with the Secretary of State's office. Are they on the line?
Chair, I can give that list. I have that in front of me because I've been actually doing that.
We can go to one of the testifiers from the Secretary of State's office. Ms. Black, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is B.B. Black. I'm the General Counsel for the Office of the Secretary of State. And the bill refers to a person through the Secretary of State. ICO members are not commissioned through the Secretary of State. And so it would only be applicable to those notaries who have filed and been commissioned through the notary public commissioning process. They apply through us, and then the governor appoints them, and they are confirmed by the other body. Usually the other body has a long printout that they don't even look at, and it takes about 5 seconds at the beginning of every session. But those are the ones who would be authorized to conduct these ceremonies, not the ex officios by my reading of this bill.
All right. Thank you for that answer. Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Chair members, well, actually, my reading of the bill is it just says notaries. We are ex officio notaries, legislator, peace officers, city clerks, county commissioners, amongst others. Then the other issue that I have is what Representative Hoyt could answer. What is the charge that the notaries could charge for performing a service like this?
Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I did not put that in the bill intentionally. I don't feel that we need to set the rate for them. But I am open to, as this bill progresses through our side of the aisle, through our house, I would be open to changing and modifying it. This is really just to fix. There is no lobby for this, I'll tell you that. No big group came to me and asked me to do this. This really came through other people saying, this is just one of those laws that we have to look at. And I'm not changing anything with the religious part of this either. It just opens a door so people that want to get married in a civil union have more options other than judges.
Further follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, members, we actually have the in statute what a notary can charge. That's $5. And then another $5 to register, bring the paper to the courthouse and get everything filed. So if somebody wants to do this, somebody wants to be a notary just to do services, they're not going to make any money on it, as you said. But there's some things that also go along with that. I got a lot of concerns with this. I don't think it's needed. And it's just putting, just makes me wonder what's going on with this, with the sanctity of marriage. It's really bothersome to me, so I cannot support this bill.
All right. Thank you for your comments. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to comment to follow up on Representative Hewitt's point that right now it is so easy to say you're a minister with a random online denomination and then be authorized to officiate over a marriage. So this would actually create more restrictions and more structure around who can Well, I guess those people could still do it that way, but I'm in support of this effort. It makes a lot of sense to me, and it wouldn't really affect the sanctity of marriage at all, in my opinion. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to make a very similar point to Representative Feist, which is that I think a notary is in many ways a more esteemed position to hold in our society than the ordained minister of the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, and which under our current law is allowed to provide marriage licenses. And so this seems to be a very sensible bill, and I appreciate Representative Hewitt bringing it forward.
Thank you. I will note for the record, I am also ordained under some random internet church so that I could perform a wedding for a friend. And I think, you know, that's what many people have done. And so I appreciate the comments. And with that, it doesn't look like we have any further discussion to the bill. And so we will move forward. There were no additional amendments other than the A1 amendment, so I will renew my motion that House File 575, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Robbins.
No.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
Cool. So by my count, we have, I believe it's 12 ayes and 4 noes.
That was also my count. With that, the motion prevails. House File 575, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. It was nice to have you here, and even if we couldn't have donuts, but I appreciate the virtual attempt to acknowledge that you would have brought donuts. So thank you very much. We'll move on to the last last bill on our agenda today, which is House File 321, Representative Feist bill regarding U visa certification. Just want to remind members, so this bill was already heard in public safety, but it's coming to us because of a provision of the bill that's relevant to our jurisdiction regarding data, and that is specifically the provision found in Subdivision 4 on lines 2.15 to 2.22. So we're going to, you know, we'll let Representative Feist introduce her bill, but we're going to try to keep discussion limited to the area that we have jurisdiction over. So with that, Representative Feist, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Should I officially request that it be moved to the General Register, or should I wait till the end?
Nope, you can go ahead and make that motion.
Thank you. I would like to move that House File 321 be moved to the General Register.
All right. Representative Feist, please go ahead and tell us about your bill now that it's before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this bill pertains to the U visa certification process. The U visa was established through the passage of the Victims of Trafficking and Violence Protection Act of 2000 as a tool for law enforcement in the detection, investigation, or prosecution of a serious crime. This classification of visas primarily benefits and protects victims of domestic and sexual violence. And for that reason, we have a lot of support and energy around this bill from organizations such as MnCASA, Violence Free Minnesota, Standpoint, from which we have a testifier today, Mission Programs, Inc. I'm actually not sure if it's Mission, Inc. Programs or Mission Programs, Inc., but we're excited to have you with us. And I've also had some great conversations with the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, which does not oppose this bill. And I am reaching out as well to the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, because this really is a pro-law enforcement bill that will create some clarity and continuity and consistency around the timelines and transparency as well, which is the focus of our hearing today. Just a big picture. I wanted to also quote one of the statements that we have submitted today by Director of Public Safety, Tony Patesnick from the City of New Brighton, who wrote, "We have found the process of certifying the form I-918 administratively uncomplicated and worthwhile in protecting victims of serious crimes in New Brighton and ensuring that perpetrators are brought to justice." So just to clarify, even though we'll be focusing on this narrow data provision of the bill, I just wanted to make it clear that this is not an immigration bill. It does not expand or change the U visa eligibility requirements. It does not require law enforcement to certify a U visa when someone comes to them. It's really just about creating more consistent timelines and also some transparency. And the benefit of this transparency is really interesting, actually, to me, because I'm a data nerd. The Immigration Service, about a year ago, put together a report because they wanted to make sure that the U visa was not being abused, that it was using as intended. And they really only had the data that was submitted with U visa applications based on certifications to the federal government. And if we do create this transparency and data collection requirement, which nine other states already have, it allows the federal government to just have much more of a clear understanding of, you know, what percentage of certification requests are being certified. If it's like 100%, then I think that says something about how easy it is to show that you were helpful to law enforcement. If it's a very small percentage of U visa certification requests, then that also says something about the integrity of those certifications. So I see this as a really important step forward in ensuring that the U visa program is helping the people it's intended to help and that it's being used properly. So I am really excited to have our presenter, Rachel Kohler. She is an immigration attorney who works at Standpoint, which works with victims of domestic and sexual violence. And she's here today to talk about that data piece, about the transparency, as well as the data privacy provisions of this bill. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Feist. And I see you have already learned as a first-term member that half the battle is explaining to people what your bill is not and not just what the bill does. So we'll move to Ms. Kohler, if you want to introduce yourself for the record and your title and organization, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rachel Kohler. I speak today as an attorney from Standpoint, a statewide nonprofit that provides legal advice and consultation to domestic and sexual violence victims, and as a member of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault and Violence-Free Minnesota, who support the passage of this bill, HF number 321. I'm speaking to you today as a supporter of the bill and to address the importance of the data privacy protections found in subsection 4. Subsection 4 specifically states that certifying entities are not to disclose the immigration status of the victim of the criminal activity, except in compliance with federal law, a legal process, or with the victim's permission, and to classify such data as private data. There are many reasons that the protection of this information is important and an important element of this bill. First, protecting victim privacy is consistent with the purpose of the U visa, which was created to strengthen the ability of law enforcement to investigate and prosecute cases of domestic violence, sexual violence, and human trafficking by building trust between law enforcement and the immigrant communities they serve. Having these protections in the bill will inform immigrant crime victims that it is safe to come forward and report crimes against them, knowing their immigration status will be kept private. Abusers of immigrant crime victims use threats of deportation to maintain control over them, to silence them, and to create fear of law enforcement and the criminal process. Providing these privacy protections will help to counteract these abusive tactics. Additionally, protecting victim privacy is consistent with our own state laws. Minnesota law protects the crime victim's identity at their request and provides automatic privacy protections to victims of sexual assault and child abuse. Protecting victim privacy is also consistent with protections which exist in federal law through the Violence Against Women Act, which prevents abusers, traffickers, and other crime perpetrators from obtaining any information about even the existence of a U visa application. Lastly, this bill will provide important information and transparency around the processing of U visa certification requests for victims of domestic and sexual violence. It asks certifying entities to create a certification process within their own agency and then to do outreach to inform victims of what that process is. Currently, each certifying entity develops their own individual process for considering U visa certification requests, if such processes are developed at all. As an immigration attorney, I often need to contact each law enforcement agency connected to each of my clients' cases to determine what their individual requirements are for requesting U visa certification. This creates hardship for the attorney and for the victim, who is already juggling a mountain of considerations in the wake of an assault. If no process for considering U visa certification requests exists, it creates hardship for the law enforcement agency that must try to determine how to handle such requests on an ad hoc basis. By requiring the creation of a U visa certification process and by requiring transparency of that process to the public, we are reducing barriers to victims and ensuring that each certifying agency knows what to do with a U visa certification request. I want to take the last seconds of my time to encourage support of this bill more generally. What this bill actually requires is very limited in scope and very reasonable in its terms, but it has a large impact on encouraging and building trust between immigrant victims of crime and law enforcement. Please join me in supporting its passage. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kohler. Members, any discussion to the bill? I know we have a couple people on hand if there were additional questions. But again, we're going to try to stick to the data section of the bill. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just wondering if either the bill's author or the testifier might be able to tell me if there are other areas in statute where a person's immigration status is classified as being private. I'm aware that their identities and those different things. I'm familiar with current statute, but I'm just wondering if there's other areas of statute that you know of that keep a person's immigration status private.
Representative,
I do have a follow-up question.
Representative Feist.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Scott. I'll answer, but then I'll also throw it to one of my experts. But, you know, I think under state law, the immigration status is often totally irrelevant. There are a lot of federal laws where immigration status is very relevant. But I would like to throw this question to Julia Decker of the ACLU, who is on hand as well. So Ms. Decker, could you answer that question?
Yep. Ms. Decker, please introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Sure, Madam Chair. Thank you. Julia Decker. I'm the policy director at the ACLU of Minnesota. I actually don't know the exact answer if there is another place in statute that specifically makes that particular piece of information private. I'm not sure if research or counsel might be able to look into that for us as well. So I think that would be my initial answer.
Okay, Representative Scott, follow up. And I will ask staff to try to look into that. And maybe as we have further discussion, maybe we can get an answer by the end of the hearing. And if not, we can certainly email that out to folks and post it on the committee website. Representative Scott, follow up.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. If you could have nonpartisan staff get an answer on that. That would be great. I'm sure they could probably provide that before the end of the hearing. And then my other question has to do with data sets. And one thing that's really important in this committee is if somebody is asking for data or wanting to keep certain data private, it's important to know what data sets they're asking to collect. And so what data does the non-immigrant crime victim provide to law enforcement in order to obtain a certification in this legislation?
Representative Feist, and then we'll go, it looks like Nathan Hopkins from House Research has his hand raised, but I'll let Representative Feist take a crack at that before we go to Nathan.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Scott. So it's important under this law that the requests for certification and the response is collected. So how many requests they received, how many certifications that they issued. In terms of what goes into a request for a U visa certification, it's a form I-918, which is completed primarily by the victim, describing what the crime was, how they were helpful. That is accompanied by all of the relevant documentation of that crime and their participation, cooperation with law enforcement. So basically we make it as Director of Public Safety, Tony Patesnick, mentioned it's administratively easy for law enforcement because the victim actually provides all of the documentation up front so that they can verify the validity of the request and the underlying facts. I don't know if that 100% answers your question, though.
You can clarify, Representative Feist.
Oh, I was going to say that I would love to have Julia Decker's input again, but my understanding, like in my mind, the most important thing that this bill does in terms of transparency is that we know, you know, what their process is and, you know, how many requests they have received and whether they have certified. In terms of the specifics of each individual victim's facts, that it seems more important to keep private in this context. And I would love it if Ms. Decker, would you like to weigh in as well on this?
Ms. Decker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I would just echo that the collection of the aggregate data as to certifications is going to be very helpful. And I would also just note, just reiterate as well on the documentation that is included for the certification request is often very extensive and involves a lot of additional supporting documentation in order for the law enforcement agency to make a decision about whether to certify or not.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Decker. I'm gonna go to Nathan Hopkins from Nonpartisan House Research. Mr. Hopkins, help make us smarter about this, please.
Madam Chair and members, so Representative Scott had asked whether there was anywhere else in state statute where a person's immigration status is classified as private or protected in some other way. I'm not aware of any other place in statute that addresses immigration statuses. Part of the reason for that is because the federal government is primarily concerned with enforcing immigration law, not the state government. So there's not a lot of state law regarding immigration statuses in general. So at the federal level, I don't believe it's possible to find out someone else's immigration status. You can FOIA your own immigration status and get your own documents that way. But there is an exception to the FOIA law. That's the federal government transparency law, the Freedom of Information Act. There's an exception to FOIA, which protects individual personal privacy, so it's difficult to find information about other people's records through FOIA requests if the person is still alive. So that's sort of the state of things at the federal level. And also, for instance, the E-Verify program where employers can find whether or not someone's work eligible, all E-Verify does is give an employer a yes or no answer to whether or not the person's eligible to work in the United States. Doesn't give any detailed information about their immigration status. So at the state level, no, there's no other statutes that I'm aware of that address the privacy of a person's immigration status. But like I said, that's because the state doesn't do a lot of work in terms of enforcing immigration laws. That's more in the federal government sphere. I hope that's helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. Follow-up, Representative Scott.
So thank you. So, it's more of a federal issue. And I guess part of this leads to the question of, and I understand the reason for, you wanting crime victims to come forward and that sort of thing. But if I'm not mistaken with this bill, I'm just concerned that this is going to be a way for people to say that they've been a victim of a crime, a sexual crime or a crime of violence, and therefore get protection to stay in the country, just to stay in the country when they're here illegally. And so that raises concerns for me, and I think those are the same concerns I had last year about this. It's keeping private some data that really in the state of Minnesota we've not dealt with, so it's sort of a new thing. So I just have concerns, and I don't know how many of these cases, maybe this is a question for the first testifier, Ms. Kohler, how many of these cases come forward each year that we'd be, that we're talking about here? And then that's my final question, and I'll just put myself back on mute, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Scott. And I do see that one of the on-deck testifiers is ready to respond. So, Ms. Bush, if you could unmute yourself and introduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead with your response.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. My name is Sarah Bush. I am the Community Engagement and Outreach Coordinator for Missions, Inc. Programs. And I am here because we have an immigrant and refugee program that provides legal advocacy to domestic violence victims who are immigrants and refugees. So our program works with folks who are pursuing a U visa on a daily basis. And for one thing, I want to state that it is a lengthy process and not something that is easy or quick to obtain. So it is not something someone does if they don't have a good reason and are motivated. The other insight I wanted to provide from the victim standpoint is that for many of the victims that our immigrant refugee advocate works with, they may not be aware of their own immigration status because their abusive partner is using that information to manipulate them or to control them, or in fact has lied to them about their documentation status. And so part of what the bill is allowing for is for someone who may not be aware of their own legal status or lack thereof, but who is the victim of a crime, to come forward and be able to get the protection of the U visa that the U visa is intended to provide. So I just wanted to add some perspective from the victim side of this equation.
Thank you, Ms. Bush. And I will note as a former domestic violence prosecutor that, these can often be matters of life or death for the victims in many of these cases. Representative Feist, did you have further follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to respond to Representative Scott's very good questions and concerns. One point I wanted to make that follows up on Ms. Bush's comment is that the immigration status may actually not be clear. I've worked recently. Sorry, I'm gonna take a drink. I've worked recently with a number of women who are on dependent visas, who are in a violently abusive relationship. My phone is ringing. That's annoying. Okay. Anyway, I've worked with women who have potentially have legal status. They're not sure. But if we were to request a certification in their specific suburb with their law enforcement and then their immigration status or what they think it is were public, it actually would identify them to their abuser. And so I just wanted to point that out as well. I also wanted to point out that this bill has nothing to do with whether someone will ultimately be eligible for a U visa. It's really just about creating a more systematic, transparent process, which ultimately I believe will help with the integrity of the process overall. So if we're concerned about it being abused, having this data collection, having this systematic approach to how we handle U visa certifications in Minnesota will really address that concern. And lastly, I just wanted to also point out that just because someone does get a certification from law enforcement, as Ms. Bush mentioned, this process is long, it's windy, it's unpredictable, and as big as the certification request is, the U visa request is like that big. And so you have to provide a ton of evidence that you have been a victim of one of the very specific enumerated serious crimes. And you also have to show that it's really impacted you, that you've really suffered as a result of that crime that is actually in the law. And to prove that is a very high hurdle. So I just wanted to address Representative Scott's valid concerns about this bill. And I'm happy, I see we have more questions, and I'm happy to answer them.
Ms. Kohler, was this a response to that topic? Okay, please go ahead.
Thank you. I just wanted to note some of Representative Scott's questions. I believe there were around, there are approximately 140,000 pending U visas right now, which is part of the reason the process takes so long for decisions to be obtained. So it's taking, and Representative Feist, if you have more up-to-date information, please correct me, but I think it's taking around 12 to 15 years to receive a final decision on a U visa. And a U visa certification actually certifies that the victim is going to be helpful in the investigation or prosecution during the entire pendency of the U visa application. So we're talking, you know, over a decade of promise to be helpful in an investigation or prosecution of a crime.
Thank you, Ms. Kohler. We do have a couple more member questions. We've got 10 minutes left, members, so please be respectful of your colleagues who want to weigh in as well. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, members, I do have to apologize a little bit. This is not going to be really beyond this issue that we're at. It's involved this committee because this bill was rushed.
Representative Johnson, I'm chairing the committee, and we are going to stick to the topic at hand. If you have other concerns that are not related to what we have jurisdiction over, I would ask you to speak with Representative Feist off the record, because I do want to make sure Representative Novotny and Representative Mueller can have their comments made as well.
I will be glad to do that, but unfortunately it was rushed through public safety, so our members could not even ask questions that much about this bill. So that's the issue. I want it to pass, but we just need some guardrails put on it. With used visas, only 10,000.
Representative Johnson, I'd encourage you to speak with Representative Feist off the record. Representative Novotny, you had a question.
It's not a question, Chair. I just wanted to say that I am going to be voting for this, and I encourage people to remember that this is our primary focus should be on protecting the victims. I want to make sure that any victim of trafficking or anything like that has the confidence that they can go to law enforcement and that they will receive protection that they want. This is the kind of, as so many barriers are being thrown up between law enforcement and the community, I think this is something that will help and take that step forward. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Botney, for refocusing us on the bill at hand. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and also thanks, Representative Novotny, for those comments, too. I was just going to point out that protecting victims is the ultimate goal with this. We know that sexual assault and domestic violence victims often don't report. It's one of the most underreported, if not the most underreported. Those are the most underreported types of cases, and so you know, the notion of false reporting just isn't really consistent with the information we know about the lack of reports from victims. Also, protecting victims' privacy is crucial. As a prosecutor, I worked for decades, actually, on protecting victims' privacy, because when they do come forward, you know, they should still be able to maintain that sense of privacy, and I'm glad that this bill addresses that. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. And finally, Representative Hollins, and then we'll move to the vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I honestly am just echoing what the previous two representatives have said. I worked in family law, and I've seen firsthand how these sorts of things impact, especially immigrant clients, and how folks do not want to come forward because of this, and they are afraid of what might happen to them. And so I really am supportive of this bill, because I think it's an important step forward in all of our legislation. So thank you.
Great. Thank you, Representative Hollins. Representative Feist, there were no amendments, first of all. So Representative Feist moves that House File 321 be recommended to be placed on the general register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Herf?
Aye.
Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Mortensen?
Aye.
Representative Novotny?
Aye.
Representative Farr?
Aye.
Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Right. We have 16 ayes.
All right. With that, the motion prevails. House File 321 is recommended to be placed on a general register. Thank you, members. We got a lot done, and it's 9:55. So thank you, everybody, for the discussion today. We did send out notice last night of what's on the agenda for next Tuesday. I do want to acknowledge that it does get a little tricky with an 8:30 a.m. hearing on Tuesdays and working over the weekend and getting stuff together right away on Monday morning for amendments. So just remind folks to take a look at those bills sooner than later so that you don't get in a time crunch. But do feel free to reach out to staff if there's some kind of reasonable holdup in getting an amendment drafted. You know, we're certainly welcome to work with members to make sure we're everybody's rights as members are being upheld and that we can still get good work done and make our bills better if they need to be improved. So thank you, everybody, for your work this week. We are adjourned.